Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with Security Shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Hola.
Hello. This call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow. Ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow. Now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
I mean, what's Pro Football Focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
Hey, as a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFL.
Ready to get into it?
Yeah, yeah.
All right. We're going team by team. I will be very careful about slinging stuff. Am I going to get sued?
Are we going legal on this?
I like football. I like football season and all the things that go with it.
Yep, despite one of the lowest over-under totals to have been set in years, there were honest-to-goodness touchdowns scored last night on Thursday Night Football. The New England Patriots bounce back and get a W against the Pittsburgh Steelers. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about buying and selling some teams on the fringes of the playoffs, like, say, Pittsburgh, for example. And, of course, we will get into the boo-boo breakdown with the great Vic Troha. But to do all that, we got to welcome in our guy, Brad Spielberger. How's it going, Brad?
Great. We should have known that Zappy Hour hits different on a Thursday night. That's what we should have realized going into the game.
Zappy Hour. Zappy Hour is good. I like that. Hadn't heard that actually yet, but that's a good one. I like it. Well done. First, obviously, we've got to give an update for anyone that was listening to yesterday's show. We have a cloud/weather update from somebody called The Danimal on the YouTube comments. This guy posted and said, "My time has come." For you, Brad, and anyone else that wasn't listening to yesterday's show, we were speculating in the weather reports what exactly constitutes, you know, partly cloudy versus cloudy versus whatever else. Anyway, this guy says, for weather forecasts, the sky is divided into eighths. 0 eighths is considered clear. 1 to 2 eighths is considered few clouds. 3 to 4 eighths is scattered. 5 to 7 is broken. And 8 out of 8 eighths is overcast. Most weather apps and forecasts on TV use vague terms like partly sunny or mostly cloudy, so they're never outright wrong. So for the forecast partly cloudy, you probably see like 2 to 3 eighths of the sky covered with clouds, but mostly sunny, it would be 1 eighth. Just enough clouds that it's not clear skies. So there we go. We actually had expert opinion chiming in on the great debate of yesterday's show, rather than myself and Steve just idiotly opining on something we knew nothing about.
It turns out cloud analytics is not just Amazon Web Services. There's more kinds of cloud analytics out there. So I'm glad I'm here for that. Now I know.
The meteorologists were there first, you know. Amazon might be the big latest guy on the block with all the money and all the servers, but those guys were doing the hard yards before anybody else. So you show them some respect, Bradley, you and everybody else. Anyway, before we get into the actual game, we've got to talk about securing your family's financial future, starting with life insurance. Fabric by Gerber Life makes it quick, easy, and affordable to protect your family so you can get back to enjoying life. Fabric was designed by parents for parents to help you get a high-quality, surprisingly affordable term life insurance policy in less than 10 minutes. Fabric has flexible policies that fit your family and your budget with quality policies like $1 million in coverage for less than $1 a day. Get your personalized quote in minutes and then apply when it's convenient for you. It's all online and on your schedule. You could go from start to covered in less than 10 minutes with no health exam required. Join the thousands of parents who trust Fabric to protect their family. Apply today in minutes at meetfabric.com/PFFNFL. That's meetfabric.com/PFFNFL. M-E-E-T, fabric.com/PFFNFL. Policies issued by Western Southern Life Insurance Company, not available in certain states, prices subject to underwriting and health questions. Whew. Okay, Brad, what was your big takeaway from this surprisingly productive New England Patriots victory?
I think there's a lot of different ways to take it. Obviously, the football itself we could talk about. We will talk about a little bit. I think really, though, I kind of thought more and more watching this game. I've probably talked on this show about my thoughts on there being Monday to Saturday coaches and Sunday coaches, and kind of, you know, you fall in those buckets if you're great at draft and develop and building up players and, you know, preparation. But then maybe on game day, you're not very good with decision making and things of that nature. And Mike Tomlin, like, you know, there's obviously some heat on him now, and there's been a lot of conversation about the deficiencies of that team. A great stat that John Ledyard shared was that he's 7-30 on his last 37 challenges, which is honestly remarkable. Yeah, like, and there are now teams that just have a guy in a booth that tell you when to challenge.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why every team wouldn't just spend, I don't know, $60,000 to just never have that issue ever again. But anyway, so like that just stuck out time and time and time again. Punting on 4th and 1 from what, like his own 45 at one point, maybe a couple times, frankly, where he probably should have gone for it. I think Bill did that as well. He did. There was a 4th and 0.5 yard for Bill from his own 45 or so where they punted in the first half. Like, I think the thing that I come back to is when we talk about football as a sport in the NFL, maybe why they were later to the analytics game than others, I think what I come back to, and it's so prevalent in Pittsburgh right now, and I think in football, more so than the other sports, if you have the better players, the better athletes, the better dudes, you can just win on sheer talent and ability. Like, obviously, it's such a complicated sport. There is so much nuance to it, but I think until 5 years ago, like, you could. Obviously, NBA, you need, like, a top 10 player to be a contender, but baseball, basketball, hockey, etc., to me, like, you can't just have better guys and just kind of like that's all that really matters at the end of the day, and you win a bunch of games as a result. And that was the case even recently, and Pittsburgh still has that. It's why they're still have a winning record, but they're just losing on the edge cases every single week. And you know, you don't have Cleveland and Cincinnati giving you 4 free wins a year in your division anymore, you know, in part because Cleveland is at the forefront of data analysis, and all these other teams are kind of just not letting those little, you know, edges go to waste. So it's just that kind of, you know, like, was that the last game we saw of Belichick versus Mike Tomlin? I don't know. But if Tomlin doesn't change a lot of things about what he does, he's not going to get fired this offseason, but I've been pushing back on that. But I mean, he's horrific on game management. It's remarkable.
That got the round of applause from Tyler in the booth, the idea that Cleveland was no longer just going to roll over and give you wins. There are some kind of remarkable stats to come out of that game. I think the Steelers essentially, you know, they put themselves in this crazy position of having a really good record despite being outgained in like every game, you know, up until that the point where they fired Matt Canada. The point in their schedule, which looked the softest maybe, right? This run against Cleveland, who just lost their quarterback, Cincinnati, who just lost their quarterback, then Arizona and then New England. They've just gone 1-3 on that stretch. Like, that should have been the run of 4 games that kind of propel them towards, you know, top seeding in the AFC. Instead, it's the run of games that's dropping them out. They apparently became the first team in NFL history last night that had a winning record to lose against 2 teams consecutively that are 8 games below 500. Like, that's never happened before in the history of the game to go back-to-back losses to Arizona and New England with a winning record. Just absolutely crazy stuff. But I think you bring up this interesting point that has always struck me about head coaching hires. The job is so broad. It's 17 different jobs rolled into one, right? And you can be an all-time great. You can be Bill Belichick. You can be Mike Tomlin and be lousy at multiple aspects of that job. You can be Sean McDermott and think it's a great way to get guys on board by referencing 9/11. Like, apparently it's really easy to be terrible at multiple aspects of your job and still be a very good overall head coach, because it's 17 different jobs rolled into one. But I'm with you. I don't understand why, you know, these guys don't therefore delegate areas of responsibility that they're bad in, right? And say, this is the thing that evidently I'm not great at. It's really easy to find somebody that can do this and just tell me the answer live, right? I can stick to setting the culture of the franchise to coaching during the week to, you know, the broad stroke stuff, right? Making sure, like, having a word in the ear of George Pickens on the sideline when he's getting upset that nobody's throwing him the damn ball. I can keep doing that, but somebody just tell me when we go or no go on fourth down. Just give me that signal. How hard is that? But they don't want to give up that responsibility.
But it's always this beautiful irony of, like, they probably wouldn't be the people they are if they didn't have that inability to delegate and to trust other people to take on some aspects of what they do. And so it's kind of funny. It's like they wouldn't be Mike Tomlin and Bill Belichick if they didn't just want to control every single aspect. But at the same time, it's also now creating this glaring weakness and problem in their process. And even ignoring the fourth down stuff, because, you know, some coaches just feel differently. Like, if you're that bad at challenging because you're staring at a big board in a stadium, and we now have guys that can just sit in a booth and watch a million different camera angles and broadcast angles and just simply see more than you faster. Like, that one, there is zero subjectivity to that in any way, shape, or form. It is an objective. And of course, you can get it wrong. Refs get stuff wrong every single week,
right?
You know, including the long snapper penalty last night was the latest joke from refereeing. It did not, in my opinion, have a huge bearing on the game. I guess it kind of did, but, you know, like, if you're the Steelers and you're blaming that for the loss, you're kind of missing the forest for the trees. But yeah, no, it is kind of fascinating and remarkable. And even Tomlin in his post-game presser basically said the reason they lost was because on their turnover they got 0 points, and on the Patriots pick they got 7 points, which to me again is like, yeah, that it was part of it, but you know, you're kind of missing the forest for the trees again. And I guess credit to him for going on fourth down. I joked when it was going, it was a TV timeout, and I was like, there's an 100% chance they're kicking a field goal on fourth and two from, like, the 8-yard line here. And I was kind of shocked they didn't. The fact they didn't convert means probably the next time they won't, which is obviously not the takeaway you should probably have in that scenario. Right. You shouldn't throw a shuffle pass to Jaylen Warren 2 yards behind the line of scrimmage for him to get blown up by a defender. But yeah, anyway, we can get more into the real football and whatnot, but there was just so many, I think, overarching high level takeaways and just kind of, like, larger narratives, because this is a legacy matchup, two first ballot Hall of Fame coaches, and we're slowly seeing the game pass them by.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, the biggest reason that the game went the way it went is that Bailey Zappe, who had looked abysmal and, you know, had no business being a starting quarterback, comes in and has a good game, makes several pretty good big-time throws. I think he had 2 big-time throws for the game, 3 touchdowns, actually made some big plays, right? And conversely, Mitch Trubisky, who's supposed to be the veteran steady hand, the high-end backup, the guy that can come in and might not make any difference to Kenny Pickett, ends up with a grade in the 40s and looks terrible. I mean, they had literally, it was masterful comic timing by the Bisc. They had just finished, Herbie had just finished talking about what a steady hand presence he brings and his experience and his, you know, veteran ability to just keep the ship pointed in the right direction. And then he just, like, wildly throws the ball into a horde of Patriots defenders on a screenplay after he'd done, you know, a ridiculous turnover earlier. It's like, I mean, that's the difference in the game, right? One backup quarterback played quite well. The other one played like crap.
110%. It's funny. I'll be honest. I saw he had 2 turnover-worthy plays. I'm going to go dig into the film. I saw about a half dozen last night, but one of them was the penalty called back, so obviously that wouldn't actually, you know, file as one. And I think it was a bit of a ticky-tack penalty. And even if, like, the penalty was real, the throw was still horrendous. But I'm sure he has a bunch of minus a halves and minus ones because he has a 40 passing grade. So that checked out. That matches the eye test, no question. The funny thing, too, you talk about Zappe. He did play well. Not to take away from that, but kind of going more into the Steelers and Mike Tomlin. So they had the most expensive defense in the NFL in terms of cap hit in 2023, which is not perfect. Obviously, cash and other things matter. But nevertheless, they are spending more on the cap on their defense than any team in the NFL. The first two touchdown passes are DeMonte Kazee and Levi Wallace just getting beaten. And right. Frankly, those guys should not be starting on an NFL team in 2023. Like, with all due respect, they shouldn't. And that shows the weak link nature of a defense. And yeah, they had injuries to TJ Watt and Alex Highsmith. Obviously, that's massive. But Watt comes back, plays in the game. I thought rushed the passer well. Cam Hayward's healthy again, playing good football. But it just shows, again, like, you spend all these resources on this unit and then just have these glaring weaknesses at a couple spots. and that can determine outcomes of games because you have below replacement level starters at two secondary positions that, yeah, I mean, got burned a couple times. But no, Zappe played well and threw some nice downfield passes and deserved, you know, second half was just kind of run, punt, but, you know, deserved the win and played really, really well in the first half.
Yeah, it's definitely a defense that hasn't played to the level that we've kind of become accustomed to Steelers defenses playing at, despite all that investment and all the money put in it. I think we do need to touch on the officiating late in the game as well, because I think there were two hideous calls, or a call, no call, two hideous officiating elements that absolutely screwed the Steelers. So you've got the false start penalty, apparently, on the long snapper, which is... So that's on fourth down, fourth and two, fourth and three, whatever it was.
Fourth
it was a first down
yeah.
if it was a five-yard penalty, right?
Right?
So they miss out on extending a drive because they decide the long snapper's head movement was the penalty, not the defender's jumping offside on the play. Everybody, literally everybody on the field was convinced it was a New England penalty, including the guy that jumped, right? Whoever it was, 48, the linebacker for the Patriots, was like, oh, what have I done? This is a catastrophic error. Presley Harvin's out there like doing dances and like, you know, pumped up celebrating because he knows they've just caught them offside. Everybody is convinced this is a Patriots penalty. And then they're like, nope, false start on the long snapper. And they show the replays of this. Now, look, slow-mo replay, you can never really get a great idea of like what, because it's one of these areas, right, where the rule is itself a gray area. It's like, I forget what the wording is, but it's like sudden and, you know, unusual yeah. movement or something, right? Which is obviously a highly subjective term. You can never figure that out from a slow-mo replay because nothing looks sudden, right? That's the whole point of slow-mo. But you run that full speed. It was a normal pre-snap routine from a long snapper. Nobody looked at that except apparently the official and went, that's a false start. Everyone was just, that's what the long snapper does. You know, head up, start to play. I mean, that absolutely screwed Pittsburgh on that drive. And then the other one, the fourth and two play where they took the shot deep down the field, Jonathan Jones, I think it was Jonathan Jones, right? Full on like hooks, was it Deontay Johnson's arm? Like he never has a shot to reach his second arm up at it because his arm's being pulled behind him. It's crazy.
Yeah, it was Deontay Johnson. I still also, and this is not just a Steelers thing, the amount of go balls that I've seen thrown on fourth and short in the NFL
yeah,
this year
hate
is a literal epidemic. And I get like wanting to, you know, maybe think, okay, defensive pass interference, which you're saying should have been called.
Yes.
I do remember there being a good amount of contact. I guess I don't remember it as crystally as like the insane false start penalty. But like, you know, maybe that's true. But I kind of had the thought last night, like, and obviously as a backup quarterback, but if you think, let's say you're a starter out there, if you think on a fourth and short that the best way for you to get a first down is to draw a DPI, you need to either draft a quarterback or fire your offensive coordinator the following offseason. Like, it's very simple. It's very, like, if that's what you think is the best path to getting a first down, then you need to do one of those two things or both. But,
yeah
no, I mean, the officiating is a story every single week. It's insane, but... At the same time, we're on the field for the fourth and three. And yeah, fourth and three is different than fourth and two, fourth and one. You're not supposed to go for it every single time. But where were they? Again, the 45 or so yard line with 5 minutes to go?
Yeah.
Probably should go for it. Like, you know, or at least there's an argument.
Yeah, it's like it's one of these tough situations, right, where I don't think it's – you can't say the Steelers lost this game because the officials screwed them, right? Because – they, you know, they lost the game because Trubisky was terrible and they put themselves in a giant hole early and, you know, DeMonte Casey just watches like a cover two shot sail over his head. Like those kinds of things. That's why they lost the game. But they did put themselves in a position to potentially dig themselves out of that hole and turn, you know, snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. And that was prevented from happening by the officials on, I think, those two calls. I think the false start one was just objectively egregious, terrible call. That drive should have continued for Pittsburgh. I think that no call on defensive pass interference was a bad miss no call as well. I think when you see that replay from two different angles, actually, you see Jones's left hand grabs hold of Deontay Johnson's right hand, and he never gets a chance to even move it in the direction of the ball. That's why he turns towards the DB because his arm is being pulled back from him. I think that was an egregious no call as well. But that's one of those, like, that level of officiating is exactly what you're saying. You can't rely on getting defensive pass interference on a fourth and two shot because the guy's going to look right at it and decide it's not a pass interference penalty. Like, you can't. It's like that the MMA line, right? Never leave it in the hands of the judges because the judges are incompetent. Like, don't rely on the officials giving you the obvious penalty that you've drawn because they're not.
Yeah, because gestures at this entire season. Yeah, so, right. You know, some of the positives, two positives, and I have a question for you tied to the second one. You didn't prepare for it, but I'm sure you've seen some of the discourse, and I think it's a fascinating topic right now in NFL conversation. So, first, shout out Ezekiel Elliott, not only for his offensive production, bunch of receptions, almost had the game sealing run. You know, obviously they still basically sealed the game by getting, you know, so close in the third down. But also, I mean, his chase down tackle on, what was it, Michael Walker, the linebacker for the Steelers, preventing a defensive touchdown. Yep. I mean, that was maybe the play of the game. So, you know, just credit to him. Shout out Zeke, like, goes to a team that is 2-10 and is still max effort every single rep. Gets a full workload, gets to kind of show, well, yeah, he's not 2016 Zeke, but he wasn't a problem last night in any way, shape, or form. So, thought that was cool for him. Also, the second positive. So, Deontay Johnson on his touchdown. At first, I thought it was a dot from Mitchell Trubisky. I still do think the layering of the throw or kind of, you know, the trajectory was very, very perfect. Great touch pass over the defender who couldn't make a play on it. However, you watch the replay, and Deontay, the entire middle of the field is open, and it's thrown to his outside shoulder, and Johnson makes a really, really nice adjustment to catch it over the outside shoulder. So, the discourse, the conversation has been going on for a while. I guess I would shout out Theo Ash tweeted about it like 6 weeks ago and has me in a rabbit hole of watching a bunch of film and thinking about it since then. But also Robbie Greer tweeted about it yesterday. It's kind of been a topic of conversation. So, is deep field accuracy, or how much of deep field accuracy, deep passing accuracy, like, is that a wide receiver stat? Like, you know, we talk about, like, you know, sacks or a quarterback stat, whatever. Is downfield accurate throwing more of a receiver stat than we maybe give it credit for, based on those guys' ability to kind of adjust and make plays?
Yeah, I think it's wildly dependent on receiver talent. I think there are so many plays. If a wide receiver is good on the deep ball, there are a ton of plays that you literally never even consider if the ball was accurate or not, because it looks like it lands perfectly in his hands. But if you sort of plot out, like, this is a really good example, right? If you plot out where the route was going, where the space was, and where the ball should have been, and then plot out where the ball actually ended up, they're not even in the same zip code, right? Now, vertically, it's dead on. Like, vertically, it was exactly, right. It was thrown the precise number of yards from the line of scrimmage that it needed to be. But laterally, it's like 5 yards off, right? And Jordan Love had a bunch of those plays earlier in the season where it's like, this is complete, but it's way off where it needed to be. Like, it's yards away from where he wanted to put that ball when it left his hands. And I think there's a lot of times where receivers make plays like the Deontay Johnson one, or, you know, less dramatic versions of those, and essentially erase bad ball location from your thought process on the play. You're just like, great play by the quarterback, got it out there, you know, DB couldn't get to it, therefore it's a great pass. But actually, in terms of accuracy, it was way off where he wanted to put it. So, yeah, I would agree. I think it's a hugely dependent stat, deep throwing. And I think you can see that in very broad terms with things like, you know, Joe Burrow goes from one of the least accurate deep passing quarterbacks in the NFL to now you get Ja'Marr Chase and all of a sudden it's college LSU Joe Burrow's back in the building, right? Like, I don't think that's a coincidence. I don't think it explains all of it. I'm sure there was some NFL adjustment to Joe Burrow, you know, coming into the league, and just the difficulty level was higher, et cetera, et cetera. But I think Ja'Marr Chase makes a big difference to that. So yeah, I would imagine it's a very dependent stat for wide receivers.
Yeah, no, so just kind of something that's been bouncing around. I think there was a throw from Dak to Tony Pollard on primetime, like, again, 5-6 weeks ago, and I think Aikman or whoever was calling it was like, yeah, it was an inaccurate ball, and it's like, that was, someone else tweeted about that, I'm forgetting now what tweet that was. I'm like, no, that ball was perfect. It's just like, that was a running back running a wheel route. If that was, you know, Brandon Cooks, like, he's walking in for a touchdown on the exact same throw. So, I don't know, I've been kind of like watching a bunch of film and kind of thinking through that for the last couple of weeks, and I thought Deontay's was a perfect example, you know, because, yeah, he made a again, like you said, that was a perfect way to put it. The depth was literally 10 out of 10 perfect. The width of the throw was not spectacular, but Deontay's a great ball tracker, or was at least in that moment. So anyway, yeah, had to highlight some positives from that game. It wasn't as ugly as we expected. Obviously, the second half was a bit rough, but I think that the last piece for me too is the total made sense. Obviously, it's like an Iowa, Nebraska total, but I think the one misconception or the one thing missing was for both of those defenses as currently constructed with injuries, etc. Their run defense right now is better than their pass. The Patriots could have come out and gone run pass in the first half, and it wouldn't have surprised me. But like they were smart to realize, like, no, you can throw on this Steelers team, especially with Trent Brown and Michael Onwenu playing good ball and blocking the edge rushers for Pittsburgh. You can throw a ton on this team because of some of the guys I mentioned. And the same in the reverse. Obviously, Jonathan Jones, I thought, had a good game. The safeties in New England, etc. But like that run defense is a nightmare to face right now in New England. But you can throw on them, and it's like, I think that was a little bit lost in the discussion of this total, which obviously what it cashed in the first half or around it. So
And then obviously big picture takeaways from both sides. I mean, the Patriots take themselves further away from picking at the top of the draft than potentially Drake May or Caleb Williams or whatever. And the Steelers' entire playoff campaign gets undermined. Now you're looking at this team and you're like, A, they drop out of the playoff running entirely. B, you're like, how the hell did this team have this many wins in the first place? What are they doing in the playoff spots at all? And that's going to bring us on to this discussion of playoff teams. But first, we've got to talk about the Eli Nagel revenge tour on the Price Picks. He's trying to get his W. He's trying to get the win. It hasn't gone well so far. But here is his lineup this week to make all that go away and erase the misery of defeat. TJ Hockenson to go for more than 52.5 receiving yards. Nico Collins to go for more than 57.5 receiving yards. And Adam Thielen to go for more than 55.5 receiving yards. So Eli is convinced that those are all going to come in. He has a long and drawn out explanation for them. Two of which I think are sound. The logic makes sense. Nico Collins, okay, it's a tough opposition. The New York Jets, their defense. But no Tank Dell. Nico's going to get a ton of targets. I buy that. Hockenson as well. I think that makes sense. Adam Thielen one, less so. But, we'll see. We'll see how it works out. Anyway, along with Eli, you can also play alongside some of Prize Picks' favorite players like rapper Meek Mill and comedian Andrew Schultz. You can find community plays under the promos tab of the app to view entries from some of the biggest names in the Prize Picks community each week. And then, listen to our picks on Eli. Prize Picks even offers a reboot policy so that your entries stay in play even if one of your players gets injured. For football and basketball games, if you have a player who exits the game in the first half and does not return in the second, that player is rebooted. Prize Picks is the only daily fantasy sports platform with an insurance policy, an injury insurance policy, that is. Go to prizepicks.com/PFFNFL and use code PFFNFL for a first deposit match up to $100. Again, that's prizepicks.com/PFFNFL and use code PFFNFL for a first deposit match up to $100.
Hola.
Hello. This call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
This is the sound of your engine getting clean. Because BP and Amoco gasolines with Invigorate clean deep in your engine as you drive, helping your car run better to take you farther. Fuel a cleaner engine with BP and Amoco gasolines with Invigorate at a station near you. Optimizes your engine's performance from the harmful effects of deposits caused by minimum detergent fuels. Requires continuous use. Results depend on what you drive and how you drive. Comparison made for fuels with the same ethanol content.
All right, Brad, we're going to look at the NFL playoff picture and whether we are buying or selling some of these teams in and around the playoffs. And it's getting kind of tight. What we thought was this fairly defined picture is actually getting muddy as hell recently. So I'm just going to fire you some teams and you give me a quick buy or sell and then like a one line explanation for, you know, why you're buying or selling them. So let's start with the Joe Flacco led Cleveland Browns.
I'm buying. They obviously, you know, are in this division with Pittsburgh, who's now lost two games in a row to horrible teams. And this is going to be a big part of it. The schedule here, you probably get a C.J. Beathard, which is huge, I think, instead of a Trevor Lawrence. And then you have Bears, Texans, Jets, Bengals. So I'm buying the Joe Flacco Browns, not just because Sobchak was going to kick me off the stream if I didn't say that.
Let's two teams within the same division. So the rookie head coach and quarterback-led Houston Texans, will they be the first team to make the playoffs since the 2012 Andrew Luck, Chuck Pagano, Indianapolis Colts?
Yep, I'm buying here as well. I think they'll beat out the Colts. They might even still have a path to the division, depending on Lawrence's injury. They have Jets, Titans, Browns, Titans, Colts. I mean, they could win all those games.
So then the Indianapolis Colts are the next team to buy and sell. The third team actually in a playoff position right now, buying or selling?
I have to sell because I just bought the first two. I do think they very well could sneak in. There's no question about it. But a little bit tougher schedule going forward. You know, have Pittsburgh going to do or die? Atlanta's probably going to need to be winning some games. I mentioned the head-to-head with Houston. You know, at Cincy looked like an easy game, and then Jake Browning went nuclear. So I guess I'm selling, but I do like the Colts and what they're building there.
All right, so if the Colts are the team dropping out, let me see if I can find the team that's jumping in. Buffalo Bills at 6-6 with a pretty do-or-die game for themselves this week. Are we buying or selling the Bills' playoff aspirations?
Do or die, maybe not the best way to put it, given light of recent events.
True.
You made the first joke, and now I had to make the second one. So, yeah, but I think they're going to find a way. I've decided they're going to beat Kansas City this weekend, which, you know, again, all jokes aside, maybe there is way too much chaos and disruption going on in that building, distractions, etc. Not even just the McDermott thing. They lost the bye week. We make jokes about winning and losing the bye week. They lost the bye week in every way, shape, or form. But anyway, I think they're going to sneak in. They're going to get it as a 7 seed and be a team that no one wants to play.
All right, the Minnesota Vikings in the NFC. 6-6, currently occupying the 6 seed, still ahead of the Green Bay Packers. Coming off their bye, Justin Jefferson returns. Josh Dobbs stays as the number one QB there in Minnesota. Are the Vikings actually going to make the playoffs?
I'm going to sell here. You mentioned the Green Bay Packers. They are going to be a bye when we get to that one. Bit of a tougher road for Minnesota going forward. You know, at Raiders, at Bengals, winnable games, no question. But two more games against Detroit and a game against Green Bay. And I'm going to say that the division, they're going to lose 3 straight to close out the year against the division, and that kicks them out.
Oof, brutal. Well, I'll skip over Green Bay since you're apparently buying them anyway. Let me jump up to an actual division leader, though. Because the Atlanta Falcons are just 6-6, but that is currently putting them in the playoffs. Are we buying or selling the Falcons making the postseason?
Yeah, they will, because they're going to win the worst division I can remember in a very long time.
All right. So the Vikings are dropping out. Who is jumping in? Let's start with the Los Angeles Rams. That team is 6-6. And I have a quarterback balling out. Like, Matthew Stafford is playing some of the best football of his career. Are the Rams somehow actually going to make the postseason this year?
That's my buy. That's my jump. Yep. This weekend's interesting. Horrific weather in that Ravens game, which I would say probably helps Baltimore even more. I don't like the matchup for the Rams regardless. But then you get Commanders, Saints, Giants. And Week 18 San Fran is super interesting. Will that game matter for the 49ers? If it doesn't, will they still want to beat a division rival in the Rams? That could maybe be a swing outcome. But yeah, this was who I wanted to get in there. I think they're playing good ball, like you said. Stafford's playing very well. I think Raheem Morris done a great job with the defensive talent that he has. I think they're going to find a way in.
All right. So that'll do it for our buying and selling teams. I want to hit one question that we got in from the Discord before we pitch over to Vic and the Boo Boo Breakdown for our injury analysis. This one came in on the Discord from Morka. I guess that's how that's pronounced. Off the show we had today, we had a segment on contract years. This is you did this, and the people signing one-year free agents. Do you think that based on the success of Houston this year will cause other teams to copy Nick Caserio's model of signing a lot of 1 and 2 year deals instead of long-term deals? Dalton Schultz, Noah Brown, Blake Cashman, Sheldon Rankins, etc. Or do we think that's not a sustainable system and it's better to sign long-term contracts that could end up handicapping the team if it doesn't work out? So in a copycat league, are the Texans setting the template to be copied?
I love this question. It's funny, and this is on record somewhere, so I said it. So when Casario first got there, I loved the approach. I loved the idea for a couple of reasons. A, you don't really know what direction you're going, so like committing long-term to a free agent, already kind of a bad proposition in general. And then let's say, you know, Mills is bad. Let's say, you know, Strat, whatever. This year, coming into it, I said, okay, you just drafted a quarterback second overall and traded up for Will Anderson. Like, you're building a foundation. Like, why wouldn't you keep Sheldon Rankins for multiple years or Dalton Schultz for a couple of years? And so it's not a bad thing. It's not inherently a problem. I guess they could get great compensatory picks or just extend them now. But this year I thought was the inflection point of, like, why not do multi-year deals? So anyway, long answer short, I do love the approach. I love the idea. When you first got there, I thought it was genius. It made a ton of sense for a lot of different reasons. I just feel like this offseason was kind of the pivot point. But hey, they're still, you know, they can retain the guys if they want to.
Yeah, I've been all over the map on that strategy. I'm still not 100% sure what they're doing, like what the actual approach is. When the first year happened, it felt like, to me, like they were just kind of treading water. It's like, we're stuck with Deshaun Watson. We can't really start this thing until we get that resolved. So let's just turn over the roster and, like, you know, field a team, right? And we'll do that with a bunch of guys getting paid $3 million for 1 year. I'm like, cool, fine. I have no problem with that. Like, you got to field a team. You got to fulfill the requirements. You got to send out 53 guys, whatever. And then the next year, once they sort of finally got rid of Deshaun Watson and got the trade and got the chance to start the whole thing, they just sort of did it again. And it's like, well, now I don't understand what you're doing anymore. Like, it made sense when you were just killing time until you could actually start the project. But now, theoretically, the project has started and you're doing the same thing. So now I'm just confused. I don't understand what the strategy is anymore. And, you know, you were sort of questioning, like, is this just what people think that the Patriot way is? You know, we sign a bunch of low price guys that maybe turn amazing if you have Tom Brady there. And if you don't have that, then it just doesn't work. And maybe they've found their version of Tom Brady, right? CJ Stroud. Now everybody that they sign is going to look like a superstar for 1 year, $3 million. But I'm a little bit like you. I still don't quite understand the overall vision that they're operating there with this roster construction.
Yeah, I think there are layers to it, though. So, like, not this year so far, but last year, they were kind of, and 2 years ago, they also did a lot of proration in the deals, making a lot of their players trade candidates, you know, and like Shaq Lawson, a couple other guys, they were able to just kind of move, and it was a bit chaotic. They probably, you'd argue, are you going to spend $5 million for a sixth-round pick? Like, is that a good investment? But I think what it did is it just gave them optionality in everything that they did, because there was no future guarantees that a team was worried about trading for, acquiring. Like, they just, I don't know if it was on purpose or it just kind of happened by chance, but I think what they just did was they gave themselves a bunch of different outs. And one of those outs, I guess, could just be the guy becoming great and you sign him to an extension. That's not really an out, but nevertheless, it'd be good to see that, right? Like, why not right now go to a Steven Nelson, go to a Dalton Schultz, go to a Sheldon Rankins, build some morale, build some positivity, and attract free agents this offseason. Go extend one of those guys now in December. Like, you know, that would be good to see, because they've all, you know, played great. And maybe you'd argue, okay, no, they're just kind of getting bolstered by, you know, scheme or whatever. But, you know, they traded for Blake Cashman before Stroud got there, before DeMeco got there, and he's having a breakout career year. They obviously saw something in him, and he's been awesome. So, anyway, it's funny. If they had Bryce Young and not CJ Stroud and they were, you know, 1-11, we'd be sitting here being like, this was the dumbest, craziest, stupidest thing ever. It kind of shows just what a quarterback can do for you. But no, I mean, DeMeco and everything they're doing, our guy PFF Bobby, and of course CJ Stroud, you know, now they have a lot of options at their disposal, and it could be a lot of good outcomes.
Yeah, I do kind of wonder if the overall vision or strategy or approach is simply, let's always make sure we have a way out. Like, let's never lock ourselves into anything that's too onerous. And if we are 100% certain, like, you know, maybe Cashman is the guy, or maybe it's Nico Collins or whatever. But once we finally get a guy that we're like, okay, guaranteed this guy's a star going forward for the next 4 years, then we can give him a long-term deal. Outside of that, everything is going to be short-term, easy to get out of, easy to cut bait if we get it wrong. And maybe that is a smart way of doing it. And as long as you hit on the important things, right, the quarterback, a wide receiver, you know, your star defensive end at the top of the draft, like, as long as we keep making the the keystone pieces, like the foundational building blocks of this thing, then it doesn't matter. Like, this is, if we goof on every single one of these short-term, you know, low-price kind of deals, it still isn't going to torpedo the entire thing.
This is a strategy, which in a vacuum, it's obviously oversimplified, but like that is, you could make a case as a roster construction asset management type of person, like that is an optimal way to run a team, where you invest heavily in building blocks, and then good but not great players or average but not good players, you're very finicky in how often you give those guys multiple years. You know, like that is kind of a strategy, not kind of, it is a strategy,
right.
But obviously, again, like there's just so much more context that goes into it, but yeah.
All right, so good question from the Discord. Now it's time to head over to the Boo Boo Breakdown and get an update on some of the biggest injuries heading into this week. All right, back again with our guy Vic Troha to talk all things injury on the Boo Boo Breakdown. How's it going, Vic?
Good, Sam. How are you today?
Not bad, good. Not bad. I think we have to start with Trevor Lawrence.
Yeah.
He's the big unknown this week, right? He got that ankle injury last week, short week. And it's the dreaded high ankle sprain. And he was at practice yesterday, albeit in a fairly limited capacity from what I could tell. But the high ankle injury is one that used to be, you know, that was going to shut a guy down for weeks. And yet it's not by any means certain that he's not going to play this week, right?
It's very surprising to see that he might play this week. After looking at that injury, when you roll your ankle the way he did, he was stepped on by his left tackle, right? So like when you roll the ankle and you actually apply even more force from some body weight, there's more potential for tearing and ligament damage, but he is at practice. The question is now going to be like when they get him into a situation where he starts to really drive off that leg and try to get more mobile, if he can tolerate the load and can get through the pain. Obviously, they're going to give him some pain relief. They're going to tape him, brace him, whatever he decides to do with his ankle, and try to get it as stable as possible. He's going to be checked out as far as the mobility aspect. Like, don't look at him to scramble or run a lot. But I think that the biggest thing is going to be, is his pain factor going to be that much to where he's not going to be able to throw the ball?
So in what way does his high ankle sprain differentiate itself from Kenny Pickett's, who, you know, had this surgery that they documented on the broadcast last night and had previously had the same thing and a different ankle in college, and that shut him down for like, I think 26 days was what they were saying. But same idea, right? High ankle sprain, except his immediately sent him to surgery. Mm-hmm. And Trevor Lawrence, it's like he might play this week.
It's the amount of damage that happens to the ligaments within that sprain. So the grade, like if there's more tearing. With Kenny Pickett, because they do a tightrope surgery where you have a syndesmosis joint at the lower part of your ankle, and they basically wrap that to secure it more. The thing is that doesn't promote better healing. It just promotes better stability.
Right.
So Kenny Pickett just had more damage to the tendons and ligaments around his ankle compared to like where Trevor Lawrence was more of like a lot of inflammation, a lot of stress, but probably less of like the tear factor in that. He clearly was injured. I mean, they made him walk about 5 miles back, right, back to the locker room with that, and he could barely put any weight on it. Initially, I definitely ruled him out for this week. So I'm surprised to still see that he's questionable. But again, they're not like trying to make him go full go on drills right now.
Yeah.
They're still letting that heal. So given that today is Friday, I'd say he'll probably put a little bit more pressure and test it a little bit more, and we'll find out in the next day or so if he's even going to be able to play.
Yeah, I mean, he was at practice, but I didn't see anything that was functional. He's standing there and he's throwing a ball and, you know, slowly stepping towards where he wants to throw. We're not doing anything that would, you know, stress that ankle yet. It is wild, some of these stadiums, like how far these guys have to hobble to get to where, like, medical attention. I mean, that was Jacksonville, right? That was where that one was. Baltimore recently had a similar thing where in order to get anywhere, they've got to like hop down concrete steps and stuff. It's like, we haven't gamed this out better so that there's like a sleek medical pathway of soft, you know, underfooting surface to get the guy from here to an x-ray.
This is your franchise quarterback. You make him walk a half mile on a high ankle sprain. That clearly isn't good for it.
Right.
But I actually kind of did laugh, though, because he's sitting there and his arms around both these guys. He's like a foot taller than them, leaning forward, putting all this pressure
on
that
one
ankle.
Was crazy. Whatever about, like, you know, a stadium where you've got to come down steps or up steps or whatever. But, like, we can't find a cart or wheels of any description. You don't have a wheelchair we can right. put him in. Like, a hospital would take care of that with just a guy pushing you in a wheelchair.
Yeah, no kidding.
Miles Garrett is the next guy I want to talk about. So Garrett injured his shoulder a couple of weeks ago, and it was another similar thing where it's like, uh-oh, he heard a pop in his shoulder. Everyone's like, that's the season done. Mm-hmm. He's going to get shut down. He ends up playing the next week, and like a few players this season, he's playing, but he's not Miles Garrett. Right. I mean, the last 2 weeks he's played, he's had three total pressures and his worst two grades of the season against not great opposition. Like, these are players that you would expect him to get half a dozen pressures in a single game, and it's just not happening. So what has he done to his shoulder, and what is it doing to him right now?
Yeah, Miles Garrett is just the testament to when you get injured, how much it can really affect your play. And I don't know if it correlates to when he got in his car accident, because he also hurt his shoulder there. But what it sounds like in watching the video, and also if you see him, he has tape, kinesio tape on the top of his arm. What it looks like is it's like a bicep tendon. And because your bicep has two parts to it that attach to your shoulder, he could have either subluxed, where you kind of feel a pop, but it's just that tendon shifting, or maybe even partially tore that tendon, and that's the pop that he felt, and that's what's causing his discomfort. Can you play with it? Yes. I mean, can you do that without surgery? Absolutely. You're at risk for a bigger injury, and I think that he's trying to play through that discomfort right now, but you can still play through it. It's not like he tore his rotator cuff. It's not like some of those other major injuries, but unfortunately for him, it's been really debilitating. I mean, he can't even take off his shoulder pads or put on a shirt after a game. I'm questioning how long you'll be able to last within the game itself. So hopefully it starts to calm down. I mean, they're going to try to secure that tendon as much as possible, but I wouldn't be surprised if it just continues to bother him.
And that's not the kind of thing that's going to heal tremendously well over the course of the season, is it?
Like, no.
Playing through that, you might be able to play, but again, is it going to, it's not going to help. It's not going to resolve itself.
Right. Well, you can't tell a DN not to use his shoulder.
I mean,
it's just like it is impossible for him to give that a break while he's playing. They are going to do everything they can to try to secure that. It's just at this point, it's going to be whether he can even be functional or not. And I do see a route, because he is one of those physical specimens where he just kind of, throughout his career, has just proven people wrong, like myself in the medical industry, by overcoming injuries. I think that he could continue to play, but I'm worried that he's just going to do more damage, and
right.
we hope that that doesn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like he's playing badly. He's just not playing at the defensive player of the year Correct. Level he was playing at before he got hurt. I mean, the last two games, there was worse of the season, but if he did that for 17 straight games, he would grade above average, and, you know, there are players in the NFL that are perfectly healthy, can't do that
right.
week in, week out. Another one of these guys that's been dealing with an injury at the same position, Max Crosby for mm-hmm. the Raiders. So he had a knee injury, which again, he's been playing through, and again, hasn't really looked like Max Crosby. And it's actually taking him off the field for periods of time, which is something that's never happened in his career.
Yeah. Did you see that picture of his knee?
No.
All right. So Max Crosby posted a picture of his left knee versus his right, and it was so tremendously swollen compared to the other side. So as soon as I looked at that, I was like, that's a little bit more than just damage to a knee. It turns out that he had to get hospitalized for that because he was in so much pain. He had an infection. And so there was an infection in his knee. Now, when I think infection, like, the first name that comes to mind is like, oh, Alex Smith with a compound leg fracture,
right?
That guy, I mean, look what happened with that situation. This, no, not to that extent. But there is some damage in that knee, and it got to the point where, like, it was swelling up so much that he had to go get on antibiotics at the hospital, get his knee drained from all the swelling. There is going to be some big concern that this is just going to continue to happen until he gets his knee under control or rehab through whatever injury is going on in there. I mean, you saw how upset he was when he had to get pulled out of the game.
Yeah.
And a player like that, it's really hard to tell, like, hey, this is not to your benefit to push through something like this. But after seeing that picture and knowing that he was hospitalized, I'm a little bit weary on that. Yeah. So that I mean, that does not look normal. Let's just say that. So,
no, that is quite a lot of swelling yes. on the screen right now.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that what they have to do is they have to obviously get that infection under control. He's going to be on antibiotics. He's going to be doing everything he can to control that inflammation. But the more he just pushes through pain, his body's going to trigger the inflammation response, and he's potentially going to have that happen again.
So is this like the inflammation and the swelling is the thing that might keep him out as opposed to battling through the injury in the first place?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he can barely bend his knee.
Yeah, I mean, that looked pretty gnarly. Yeah. That did not look fun to play through. Okay, anyone else we want to hit before we wrap for the week?
I don't think so. It's actually the one name that I'm going to just actually watch, though, and I think everybody should keep an eye out for him, is Justin Jefferson's first full week back.
Mm.
Coming off of that 8 weeks off for a hamstring, way longer than what most people take for a hamstring.
Yeah,
I think that the Vikings did this pretty intelligently, given that they're still in potential playoff spot.
And they'd been winning.
And
I think that
winning.
Was a big part of it. Like they had that, the stars kind of aligned for them, right? They were yeah. winning the games. They just needed that one more, and then they could get to the bye, and then that would give them the extra 2 weeks. So
yep.
it sort of made sense, right? And unfortunately for them, like they dropped that final game before the bye, but it made, like the timeline made sense for this to be the week for them to target for him to come back.
Yeah, so let's look, just watch how he plays. I don't see him having any hangups this week. I'm just interested to see if his hamstring holds up for the whole game.
Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully Jefferson is back at 100%, because that makes everybody's life more interesting watching the NFL. So yep. that'll do it for this week, the Boo Boo Breakdown. That'll do it for our shows for the week. Thank you all for watching, and we will see you Monday.